This episode of Literary Treks is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 150,000 titles for iPhone, iPad and iPod, Android, Kindle, Windows Phone, plus Mac or PC. To get a free audiobook of your choice, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm.
Hey everyone, I'm Rod Roddenberry, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Taking all these books?
I thought I'd take some light reading, in case I got bored.
Welcome everyone to another episode of Literary Treks, our dedicated Star Trek books and comics show. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me once again, as always, is my esteemed co-host, Matthew Rushing. Matthew, your screen name today says Starship Crasher Riker. Now, are you talking about Mrs. Riker, Troy Riker, or is this Will himself?
It's Will himself. In the book, we're going to talk to John Jackson Miller about Riker makes a really funny comment about how he crashed a galaxy-class starship once, and he'd rather do that over and over and over and over again other than go on the mission that Starfleet is sending him on. So I thought that was pretty funny. Apparently both Rikers take responsibility for their crashing of a starship. So that's nice of them. I mean, they're both jockeying for position of being the one who crashed the starship. So apparently, that's a sign of a successful marriage is when you're both fighting over who crashed the flagship of the Federation.
Well, he's standing up for his wife there. Yes, I do remember that comment that he made in the book. So like you said, we're going to have John Jackson Miller on the show today in the feature to talk about Absent Enemies, his new Titan novella. So I'm looking forward to that. But we have a lot of news today, Matthew, a lot more than we've had in recent weeks. So I think we better just jump right on into this. And what's the first segment we have today, Matthew?
Judge book by its cover. We're going to judge a book by its cover. Because when you see something on the outside, you know exactly what you're going to get on the inside. Because we're judging a book by its cover. I don't know if that's the same one as last time, Chris, but I just jazzed it up a little bit. I was thinking about a little bit of James Darren in my head,
So, well, you know, Colin did Vic Fontaine and the Jazz of DS9 on Melodic Treks this past week. So I thought maybe that helped you kind of refine the little jingle that you made up on the spot last week.
Yeah, I don't know if that one is as good as last week, so maybe, you know, if it's not, you could probably just take last week's and insert it there, or every week that we have apparently judge a book by its cover, I will just make up a new jingle. Apparently I'm the Roots band, with Jimmy Fallon. I'm almost as talented, and I am the only band that we have here at Trek FM. So sorry about that, guys.
That's right. I like the idea of just making up a different one every week. It gives the show a unique flavor. So
there you go.
Well, Matthew, this week, the book that we're judging by its cover is Fun with Kirk and Spock, which I remember that we did talk about a long time ago on the show when we first found out that it was going to be coming at some point. It's coming from Cider Mill Press. I tell you what, it looks like Kirk and Spock are up to no good on this cover.
Oh my gosh. What's great is that it does look like those, Dick and Jane books from the 30s, 40s, 50s, whatever. But yes, they're being quite mischievous here. It's a picture of Kirk and Spock sneaking up on Khan, who's still asleep in the Botany Bay.
Yeah.
It really does look like Kirk is just about to give Khan a good old wet willy to wake him up. This book looks like it's going to be really funny.
It does. Yeah. This cover is funny. Wet Willy is perfect. Maybe if they were a little bit more devious, they might be doing the tape on the eyebrow thing where you then just rip it off to wake him up and his eyebrows come off.
Or put his hand in warm water, to make
him
pee.
Yeah. Fill his hand with whipped cream and then
Make him scratch in his nose. Yeah. With a feather. Yeah.
Something like that, but that's what they are up to on this cover. And so I can only imagine what we're going to see inside this book. I think that I actually am going to pick this up.
I think so too. It looks like a lot of shenanigans are going to go down. You know, they said, you know, since the 30s, a book, Fun with Dick and Jane and its various adaptations, you know, have helped children read. And so it's inspired several parodies with movies and television references. But apparently none of them as clever as one written with Trekkies in mind. And so, you know, Fun with Kirk and Spock will hopefully delight Trek fans with creative sequences and humorous illustrations. And if the cover is any indication, it does look like this is going to be very funny.
So, Matthew, does this cover get our stamp of sufficiently exciting?
I think it does, Chris. I think this is a sufficiently exciting cover and sufficiently funny for a parody.
Yes, I think
and so, yes, I believe it does get our stamp of approval. In fact, Chris, I think we need a stamp.
We
sound
do.
Effect, you know?
Oh, okay.
You know?
I think so. I'll see what I can find right there. All right.
Oh, goodness. So that's exciting. And then, you know, what's really cool, Chris, is, you know, like you said, we got a lot of news today. And so I'm perusing around all my sites trying to find news. Come across our good friend Dayton Ward's website, and lo and behold, he's already got news about his next Star Trek book. And I'm really excited about this, Chris.
Yeah, this one's called Pale Blue Diet. And when I saw this, my first thought was that Brandon Braga has just finished remaking Carl Sagan's Cosmos TV series. And Pale Blue Diet was also a great book by Carl Sagan, a great science book by Carl Sagan that I read many years ago. And I thought, oh, is Dayton rewriting Carl Sagan? But no, this is Star Trek focused.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's probably close enough. You know, Carl Sagan also wrote tons of fiction. So this could be
one of my favorite books of all time, Contact.
Yeah. Now, Dayton was disappointed. You know, he didn't know that he was going to be following up the fall. That's kind of strange to say, following up the fall. Anyway, with another fall. But no, he didn't know he was going to be the next writer. And so he said, you know, if it had turned out to be him, he would have maybe ended the last book a little bit differently, because he had this idea of putting Picard and Chin and them going off into starting a detective agency on Wrigley's pleasure planet or something like that. I just feel like Beverly might not approve. You know, Chin is relatively hot, at least in the book. She's described as being beautiful and, you know, all she's young and whatnot. I don't know. I don't really picture her being really excited leaving, you know, Beverly alone, you know, now on Deep Space Nine with Renee all by herself, you know, just
yeah.
doesn't seem right. But
well, for those who aren't familiar with Chin, tell us a little bit about who Chin is.
Well, Chris, one of the most interesting things about Chin is she is Vulcan, but unlike most Vulcans, she does not suppress her emotions. And so she can tend to be a little bit crazy, a little bit wild sometimes. She has kind of a checkered past that Picard has really kind of overlooked. And so it's actually made her a really interesting character watching him kind of shepherd this young, you know, ensign and a lieutenant into something and shape it into something. So, you know, she's part Vulcan, part human. She doesn't follow Spock's mold where she's trying to suppress her emotions. And so it's actually made, I think, kind of an interesting character to watch. And yeah, she's also, you know, she's got the elf ears that we all like, you know. And so I just can't imagine, again, Beverly letting them just...
As you described her there, she reminds me a little bit of Vash. Maybe Picard, this is his type, I guess. This sort of checkered past, kind of wild woman. Yeah.
Yes. Luckily, actually a little bit better looking, I think, probably than Vosh. You know, no offense to the actress.
Well, Vosh is quite good looking, yeah. So that's
yeah,
that's a compliment.
But he said, really, as it happens, the Enterprise E is heading out into the unknown now. And so it looks like it's going to be some good old-fashioned seeking out new life and new civilizations and all that, you know, crap. So that we're so not used to right now. And so kind of exciting. You know, he actually has to have the manuscript delivered by Labor Day. And then will be published some point mid-2015. So We got to wait a while for this one. Disappointed on that part, but excited that Dayton's going to be back in the 24th century next year. So it's good to see.
Definitely so. And we should say that same old crap, those were not Dayton's words, right? Those were your
I just meant, you know, that the whole, like, I mean, how many times we always just quote the seeking out new life and new civilizations, right. You know?
Yeah.
That's what I meant was kind of...
It's more the standard mission of the Enterprise, exactly. Right?
But yeah. Most likely to, it's going to have something to do with whatever's going on in the 24th century. The books have been, you know, relatively well centered in the sense of there is a continuing story. So I'm sure something in there will play out that'll be interesting to everything else as well. So I'm excited. I love Dayton's work, and I'm glad to see, too, obviously, 24th Century did really well this year. They're going to be continuing that next year as well. So,
well, I think the number of books that have hit the New York Times bestseller list consecutively this year and going back to autumn with the fall shows that the audience really likes 24th Century.
Yeah, I agree. And so I'm glad that that's going to be the case. And we'll, and even more exciting, our friend James Swallow going to be writing another Star Trek book. And actually, it's been a while since he's worked in Classic Trek. He did the book about Elias Vaughn and Valeris and Spock, Cast No Shadow, in the movie era. And he said this one he's hoping is going to be something more. And harkening back to some of his favorite episodes like Doomsday Machine, Enterprise Incident, Immunity Syndrome. So what do you think about that, Chris?
Oh, I think it's great. I know that if there are too many TOS books in a row, we get kind of tired of them, but I really enjoy those stories, and it's always great when someone like James can put one together for us. And what I really like, I mean, I just said, you know, the audience seems to want 24th century, but what I really want myself is that mix. I want 24th century, and I want 23rd century, and I want 22nd century as well with the Enterprise stuff. And so, excellent. I'm really looking forward to that. And these are some of my favorite episodes as well.
Yeah, and that's great. And I love this, too. He said they're also talking about another idea with another Titan novel. And now this one, nothing's confirmed there yet. But hopefully it's going to get the go-ahead and be able to pick up after Absent Enemies here with John Jackson Miller. And so I'm really excited to see that. I love when James writes the Titan. I think he gets those characters really well. And I do hope, I got my fingers crossed, that they will get that signed in some kind of contract form soon so that James can follow that up, because that'd be fantastic.
Most definitely. Yeah. And I believe James made these comments in that recent interview that he did with TrekCore.
Yeah, exactly. The TrekCore posted an interview there with him on the Poison Chalice, and he was just talking about some of the things that were coming up for him. Yeah. And so I'm glad to have caught that. Appreciate that from them. And what I'm really glad, you know, Chris, I've been doing a lot of websites now, Trek websites, really devoting more time to the Star Trek lit, which am really excited about. The more the better, because it really helps fans, one, know this stuff's out there. And I think it's really showing in the way that the sales are playing out as well.
Yeah.
I think there's been a resurgence for fans and the excitement for Trek lit. I think it also has to do with the writing. I think that the writers that they have right now on staff writing Star Trek books are fantastic, the ones they keep contracting. And I just hope it continues. So it's great stuff.
Definitely. Yeah, you see it at TrekCore. You see it at StarTrek.com. You see 1701 News and, of course, the great 8 to 5 Trek Collective, which is a great source
and,
of news
and then,
for us.
As well, Treklit Reviews, who actually runs he's the literary editor for TrekCore, and so he has his own website. So yeah, it's just great to see that this proliferation of people really coming out of the woodwork to support Treklit, and I hope it continues again. And I'm really proud to be a part of it with our show to help get people out there and knowing about what's coming.
Yeah, most definitely. And the next thing we have here, Matthew, is John Byrne expanding the photo comics that we talked about. This is Star Trek Visions. And of course, we talked about the story when it was announced that it would become an ongoing series. We've gotten some more comments now from Chris Rael, IDW's chief creative officer and editor-in-chief, who says that what John does on these photo novel stories is nothing short of amazing.
Yeah, you know, I think it's really interesting, Chris. You know, we've talked about this. We both, I guess you could say we both kind of have reservations about it. And I'm hoping that it will win me over. Now, the cover alone for the next series they're going to do, which is going to be off the Mirror episode. It's going to be called The Mirror Cracked. The cover was fantastic, actually. Great work by John Byrne there. And this is going to be a bi-monthly series. They're going to call it Star Trek New Visions. And so, and it looks like each of these is going to be an extra length affair. So probably like a 48 page comic. And actually means, of course, they're going to cost a little bit more. But when I think about probably the work that he's having to put into this, it's extensive. It's not just your normal comic. I mean, you're having to do a lot of painstaking work here.
Yeah.
And so,
well, you know, the other thing that Rael says here is that he's moved far beyond photo manipulation and montage to constructing his own set pieces, uniforms, and characters, much more than just comic stories. These tales are the closest thing to original series era lost episodes that the world will ever see. And like you said, if he's really getting into, as it's described here, his own set pieces and uniforms and characters, then that really is quite a lot of work. And it is beyond what you might initially think of just taking stills and, you know, putting them in Photoshop and sticking them together.
Yeah. So this is going to be a lot of work. And I think that going that way, Chris, is really going to create something that I'm going to be a little bit more interested in than just the photo manipulation, but by creating their own sets and everything like that, I'm actually a little bit more excited to see that work than I am, you know, just kind of going into Photoshop and manipulating some photos.
Right. Yeah.
Because you really are, in a way, creating brand new episodes of the original series in a way that, you know, you couldn't really do unless, I guess, you went and did, you know, animated series, which honestly, Chris, I don't know if we ever talked about this, but goodness, you know, with the amazingness of the Clone Wars, Star Wars coming out with a new show, Rebels, I think you could do an incredible JJ-verse cartoon like that would just be amazing. You know, I mean, and you could get all the actors probably to come in and voice all of the episodes, you know, rather quickly. And then, you know, you just line that up with whatever the animation is. I don't know. I personally, I would be all for that idea.
I would enjoy that. Yeah, we've talked about that some on the Ready Room before. I know. And who knows? You know, I do think there's a possibility that the next Star Trek series will end up being an animated series before we get a live action series, and it may be Abrams verse. So we'll see. But yeah, I think there's an audience for that.
Well, and see, that's the other great idea too, because you really could go back and do, you know, say next gen characters, any of that, by doing an animated series. Mm. And I mean, Jonathan Frakes is a fantastic voice actor.
Yeah.
He worked on Gargoyles. So did Marina Sirtis.
Well,
so
and Michael Dorn
Titan series.
Works on all
Michael
kinds
Dorn,
of stuff.
Exactly. You know, so those guys really have done this kind of work before. They know what it takes. Man, I would be all for, you know, putting Titan in an animated series. You know,
see, that would be cool because Titan is a series that really needs to be animated so that they can really bring the books to
life
without breaking the bank. Yeah.
Yeah, I think it would be fantastic. So, you know, Paramount, take our ideas, take our money at that point. You know, we love that idea. CBS, we're just handing you fantastic ideas here. And gosh, I can't imagine. I mean, I can't imagine Frakes or Sirtis turning that kind of stuff down because you know how much they love this.
Yeah.
And
oh, I'm sure they would.
Even
do it.
They have talked about that idea of having a Titan show. So I think it'd be great.
Yeah, definitely. Well, one more item in news today, Matthew. And when I saw that this was updated, I thought, Matthew's going to be so excited. This is the fantastic Tretlet reading order flowchart over on Tret Collective. And I had gone over there recently, I don't remember when, maybe last month, and just to see, you know, what is the status of the flowchart. And I saw some comments being posted and people were asking, you know, are you going to update the flowchart with the fall? When are you going to let us know how all these things connect? And finally, it's ready. It's live.
It is, Chris. And Ada 5 and Thrawn from the BBS Trek boards have done a fantastic job of reworking this. It's bigger. You know, for me, what's really awesome is on my 27-inch iMac, it fills up the entire thing. Mm-hmm. But I can see all of it, and it's huge. So it's really great. What's really nice is that at the bottom, they've made a key for this. So they have series indicators as well. So each book has next to it some dots. And each of those dots has a color. And yeah. That color represents the series which that book follows. So say Paths of Disharmony by Dayton Ward. If you see that on there, it tells you that the little dot, it's a Next Generation book, but it's also a Typhon Pack series book. So each of the books has that, and it's really fantastic. I love it because it kind of just helps you keep in mind when you're looking at this, an even better way of understanding the flowchart and how yeah. it works. It looks a little daunting at the beginning, but honestly, it makes perfect sense when you just look at it for a few minutes.
Definitely.
I can't tell you how many times I tell people, if you are trying to get into Star Trek books and you're not sure where to start, you need to check out this flowchart. We're going to definitely link to this in the show notes. And it's the thing that you need to help you figure out where to start. So, and you know, you know where to start if you want to get into the Next Generation, right before Nemesis or after Nemesis. You know exactly where to start with DS9 after the series. You know exactly what to do with how does Titan fit in with that Next Generation relaunch. And all of that stuff is fantastic. So, and it's all here for you. In fact, you even know how the Enterprise series fits into the Destiny series because you can see mm-hmm. how that connects. Cool. This is a really great work here, and I really appreciate these guys. You know, I use A5's site, Trek Collective, all the time for news, and I send people here all the time for this flowchart because there's no better way to keep track of Star Trek literature than with this flowchart. So well done, guys. Well done.
Absolutely. Yeah. I use this flowchart myself. It should be bundled with every Star Trek novel. It should be printed out in the back.
Yeah. you know, it's funny. I actually do, Chris. I printed it out at work on an 11x17 sheet trying to get just the right. It doesn't fit as well, but it's still nice to have. But it is something that every Trek fan should have. And that's one thing that I loved about Star Wars books is that they would have the chronology in the mm-hmm. front of the book, so you'd know where the book fell in, you know, the larger time frame of Star Wars. And so this is a little bit harder because, you know, Star Trek books don't always connect exactly like that, but it does a really good job, and I really like it, and everybody should go check it out.
Most definitely. So, yeah, we'll put a link to that in the show notes. And the site, again, is thetrekcollective.com. Go over there. A really fantastic site. Well, that's everything we have in news today. Before we jump into our interview with John Jackson Miller, Matthew, we'd like to tell everyone about our sponsor for today's show, audible.com. Audible is the premier source for audiobooks. They have over 150,000 titles for you to choose from. They put hundreds of new books on the site every single week. And they have new releases, they have classics, bestsellers, business, science, comedy. They have some of the most famous Star Trek books. And what they also have, Matthew, and what I'd like to recommend today in honor of our guest, is they have John Jackson Miller's Kenobi, the Star Wars book from last year that he wrote. And I know you're a big fan of this book.
I am, Chris. It's a really great book. Obi-Wan Kenobi is my favorite Star Wars character, and to me, the ultimate Jedi. And so I was really excited when this was going to come out. The coolest part about this book, Chris, is that it takes place after Revenge of the Sith, when Obi-Wan Kenobi is on Tatooine watching over Luke and kind of about his life of trying to figure out, okay, how do I go from being, you know, an intergalactic hero and somebody who's used to inserting himself into situations to help people to living as basically a hermit and how difficult that is for him. And really what's really neat is basically it's the old Western Shane, but in Star Wars. And so Obi-Wan Kenobi is basically Shane, and it is a fantastic book. I really do love this. I highly recommend it. And I know the audiobook would be great. I only actually read this, unfortunately. I don't do a lot of audiobooks, but man, if that's the only way you can get this and support one, John Jackson Miller, and two, Audible, which they're fantastic. That's where I got my Into Darkness book from when I was doing the audiobook review from them. They're great. The app works fantastic. You can't go wrong with Audible.
No, definitely not. And yeah, this is it's a really great way to experience the novel Kenobi. It's narrated by Jonathan Davis, and it's unabridged, so it's actually 13 hours and 36 minutes. So if you
awesome.
Do a lot of commuting, and what's great about Audible, the app too, this is what I do, is that you can control the speed. So you can listen at it at like 1.5x, or what I usually do is 1.25x, because it just speeds the book up a little bit, but it doesn't really affect the my ability to understand it. In fact, it actually helps a little bit, because I find that sometimes narrators speak a little bit more slowly than I prefer. So I put it on 1.25, so that 13 hours, that drops down, you know, get through the book faster. But it's a wonderful way to experience books. Now, the regular price for Kenobi is $31.50. The member price is $22.05, or one credit. But as a Trek FM listener, you can actually get this book absolutely free. All you need to do is go over and sign up to try Audible. That's audibletrial.com/TrekFM. And when you sign up, you can get this book or any book you want absolutely free. And then you'll be trying Audible for 30 days. And if at the end of that time you decide not to stick with Audible, you get to keep this book. That's yours. So nothing to lose. And by supporting Audible, you'll be helping us keep Literary Treks coming to you every week, and you'll be getting some great books in the process. So again, go over to audibletrial.com/TrekFM and sign up. And we really thank Audible for helping us bring our shows to you.
Well, Chris, I'm really excited tonight. One is because we have an author on the show, which I know the listeners love. But two, we have a brand new author to Star Trek Lit. John Jackson Miller has been writing for a long time. His first novel was actually Star Wars Knight Errant, which was released back in 2011 with Del Rey. And it was alongside a comic book series that he had been writing of the same name. He's written several other Star Wars books, including the Lost Tribe of the Sith ebook series, as well as Kenobi, which, man, featuring my favorite Jedi during his exile on Tatooine while watching over Luke. And then what was really cool is he had his first non-licensed work, Overdraft, The Orion Offensive, come out in 2013. Now, what's really neat about John Jackson Miller, if you don't know, guys, he's also written comics ranging from Marvel Comics of Iron Man and the Crimson Dynamo. He's got Bart Simpson comics. He's done Star Wars Empire for Dark Horse. And then, of course, he was a regular writer for the Knights of the Old Republic and did the adaptation, the comic adaptation, for Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull. And tonight, he's here to talk about his newest licensed work and his inaugural Trek Lit book, Star Trek Titan, Absent Enemies. So, John Jackson Miller, welcome to the show.
Hey, glad to be here.
Hey, welcome, John.
Excellent. Well, it's so glad to have you here tonight. One, for me, you know, I'm a Star Wars guy as well as a Star Trek guy. So it was really exciting for me when I learned that you were going to be writing for Star Trek. I was like, is that a typo? Is, you know, when I saw that on I was like, he only does Star Wars. And so glad to see you. But for you, you know, I always wonder, how did you get into writing? And was it something that you always wanted to do that was your drive? Or is it just kind of something you fell into? Or what got you into, you know, writing books and comics?
Well, I started collecting comic books when I was 6 years old. My mother was a grade school librarian, so, you know, where other people's mothers said they, you know, threw their, you know, their mothers threw their comics away, my mother, you know, told me to put my comics in order. So I still have everything that I ever had, that I ever bought. And of course, this was the 1970s, and, you know, when I was starting to read this stuff, and you know, Star Wars comes out in 1977. You know, before then, I'm watching, you know, the Star Trek cartoons on the TV on, you know, on NBC, I guess it was. And, you know, I was also, you know, getting into Star Trek, seeing the TV episodes from the original series. So, you know, I think the very first comic book that I drew of my own was age six, and it was you know, a science fiction, you know, space exploration comic series, you know, with a cool, you know, a kid and a spaceship and his dog, and so yeah, I continued to do my own you know, comics and write my own stories you know, through high school. In high school, I actually started publishing my own fanzines, you know, doing reviews of comics and movies, and you know, my own mini comics. I was, you know, trading back and forth with people around the country. You know, these days people would do a web comic, but you know, we were just using a photocopier and, you know, running these things off and sending them around. And you know, I didn't get into actually, you know, writing fiction and writing comics professionally. Directly, I started as a journalist. In 1993, I became the editor for the trade magazine for the comic book industry, a magazine called Comics Retailer, and also was the managing editor and later editorial director for Comics Buyer's Guide, which is the long-running newspaper. And again, that's a magazine that has a very long history, both in comics and in you know, science fiction as well. That was a publication that Walter Koenig subscribed to back in the 1970s, and and you know, it was a focal point for some of the very earliest you know, the letter writing campaigns and things like that to get Trek back on the air, you know, someplace. I would go back and look at some of our old back issues when I was working there, and you know, read up about Star Trek II and the various other the sequel series that they were supposed to do and things that they were discussing in that age. So it was really fun to be, you know, working in a day job where I got to work with Star Wars and Star Trek. Although I wasn't actually contributing to those universes, in that stretch in there, I was actually also the editor of a magazine called Scry, which was the card game magazine for games like Magic the Gathering and Pokemon, and I got to edit articles about the Star Trek card game, and of course I'd been into gaming for years as well. You know, I think my first Star Trek game that I've got is got to be you know, one of those old West End games that they did, the board games back in back in the 80s. And of course, I read the FASA role playing rules and all these things back then. I didn't get to move to the other side of the camera, I guess, if you want to call it that, until 2003. When I got the chance to start writing my own comics, start writing comics for Marvel, I wrote a series called Crimson Dynamo, based on Iron Man villain, and then that led to a run writing Iron Man itself for a year, and then very cool. You know, that was a lot of fun, and then as you said, I went into Star Wars and I got into that, you know, just a little at a time with just a single issue that I did for that series, Star Wars Empire. That led to me getting to develop a series for them, which, as you said, was Star Wars Knights of the Old Republic. And then that thing just kept going on and on and on. It went. It went 50 issues. You know, 56 if you count the limited series that we did and the zero issue. All under one writer. That's pretty unusual for comics.
Yeah, no kidding.
And it gave me a chance to really test my abilities to, you know, build onto a licensed universe, onto a licensed world. And so that was how I got into it on the comic side. On the prose side, this is kind of interesting. I wrote Star Trek prose before I wrote any Star Wars prose at all.
Really?
This is one of those little known things. Nobody would have known it, but I submitted a story, I think in 2000, to Strange New Worlds. And that was the talent search book that they were a series of books that they were doing. It was a fun little story. It was a Scotty story. It was probably a bit over the top. I think it was Dean Wesley Smith may have been editing those. I know he wrote that he liked the story, but I think it was just a little bit too over the top. It was one of those things where I was looking to write for whoever would give me the chance next. And I did have a shot at writing one of the Star Trek SCE books, the Starfleet Corps of Engineers. Takes us right, back to yes. Scotty again. I had a pitch approved for that. Just in time for the series to be canceled. So if things had gone a little bit differently, my first, prose wouldn't have been Star Wars. It would have been Star Trek.
Right.
So it really did not feel to me like a big departure to get to do it now. And of course, that's how things came about after I had done some, novels, for Del Rey and, then I did my own science fiction book that came out last year called Overdraft: The Orion Offensive. I had been talking for a while with the folks at Pocket Books, and Ed Schlesinger and Margaret Clark, they suggested Margaret suggested, hey, how'd you like to write something for the Titan series? Or actually I was simply offered a novella. And I got the choice to, choose which crew I wanted to write, work with.
Oh, wow.
And I had always been a Riker guy.
Awesome.
I said, okay, this could be a lot of fun, and it was.
Definitely. That's so cool.
Do you also step over the backs of chairs to sit down like Riker does?
I think that there might be a moment like that in the book. I can't quite remember.
Yeah. Well, I remember that he throws a chair.
He throws a chair, and we have a couple. Yeah. We have a couple of moments that could be called facepalm moments.
Yes, yeah.
This it really was awesome. A story I wanted to write because Margaret had told me that we were going to be placing this novella right after the end of The Fall, which is the group of novels that came out in the fall. Of this last year, and there were we were going to have all these big events happening in these other books, and it just struck me that a novella being shorter than everything else, and also being an introductory point for a lot of people who don't normally necessarily get into the tie-in novels, it struck me that this would be the opportunity to do kind of a lighter story, a story that had the feeling of one of the episodes that we would see of the TV series, of the various TV series, the Trouble with Tribbles kind of episodes where, it's not the fate of the galaxy on the line. It's something where, there are important stakes and there are important things going on, but really, I think what this story is it's a mystery told over the course of what would be the equivalent would be an hour of a TV show, I think there are some fun character moments, and I also kind of got to do a little sequel here of one of the Next Gen episodes I liked at the same time.
Right.
Yeah, I think to me too. When I read one of the e-books, the novellas that they've been doing more of for Star Trek, the highest praise I can give it is to say this feels like an episode of the show.
Yeah, it does.
Whatever show that it's kind of based off of. And this really did feel like a great episode of the Next Generation that was a little bit more humorous. And it was kind of nice to have that lighter tone, that kind of insurrection tone, because Star Trek can do humor really well. And you know, after the fall, it was nice to have something that was a little bit lighter and a little bit funnier. You know, with Riker as an admiral, it was kind of like you just plopped him into an a fish out of water situation that he's mm-hmm. just not really comfortable in, and just kind of let him go. And it was fantastic.
Well, thank you. That's exactly what I want to hear when somebody reads one of these things, that it feels like the source material. This is why we, read tie-in fiction. This is why we read tie-in comics. We're trying to recapture or build off of, the feelings that are brought to us by the source material. The whole reason that there were tie-in novels to begin with, in the old days was, there was not that opportunity to, watch DVDs of a TV series or of a right. movie or not even to really see reruns in some cases, for a long time there. This was a way of extending the adventure for people, that could not otherwise, have a chance to see a film again or see a TV episode on demand whenever they wanted to. That really is to me, the best thing that you can say to an author, to somebody who's done one of these books is, this feels like it belongs, with this material. And of course the other, best thing that you can say to an author is that, this would be a good book even if it weren't a tie-in. And I think that's what you want to strive right. for as well. We really want to tell good stories, and we want to tell good Star Trek stories at the same time, or good Star Wars stories, or Simpsons or Conan or whatever we're working on. But you're trying to do both of those things at once.
Definitely. For you, we talked a little bit about this on the other side of the page before we got started. Just Star Trek Lit, like Star Wars, has a pretty extensive continuity. For you, it was kind of nice when you were writing Star Wars because you were writing in a time period where you weren't having to worry about a lot with your Knights of the Republic or the Knight Errant. Mm-hmm. You got to kind of create a lot of that. But, jumping in after the fall – series here with Absent Enemies, there's a lot of continuity that's happened to these characters since the last time we saw Riker on screen, which was a Nemesis. Mm-hmm. Have you been a reader of Star Trek Lit so that you were kind of caught up, or did they kind of have to give you the rundown of everything?
Well, I've read quite a lot of the books. Titan. I really like Synthesis. That was the James Swallow.
Yes,
that.
Yes.
I grabbed that one immediately because I was a big fan of the whole Minuet storyline that we had back in Next Gen.
Yes.
So I had read some of these books, and I'd been provided some as well by the editor, and also provided some supplemental materials on who was where. You never get everything perfect, and there's a learning curve in any universe that you're working with. I dealt with it on Mass Effect. I dealt with it on Star Wars. I'm here too. My own facepalm moment was, on the very last page of the book.
I saw that.
I got the Baku and the Sanaa mixed up, it was one of those things where you read it, you think, oh, I must've gotten that right in the beginning, and I just never check it again. And that is, we're going to fix that in the ebook release, because you can actually go back in and fix things in the digital version. But there's always a learning curve, and the fans want the same thing we want. We just want everything to be consistent and everything to be correct, and we want the universe to work and be coherent. And
Right.
I think that the trick with these things as well is knowing how much of what exists to bring in.
Right.
And particularly in the case of a novella, an e-novella at that, the goal of the project is to a degree dictated by the medium. Because the idea with these things is to go out and target the new reader, to go out and target the reader who is probably more familiar with the TV characters, the movie characters, those incarnations, than, you know, what's been out there in the literature. You know, with a product like the project like this, we're probably more likely to, you know, highlight the more familiar names. So, for example, here we had three major point of view characters, and I chose Riker and Tuvok and Christine Vale. The notion there being, okay, we have these two characters who, you know, are very familiar to viewers, and so they've already got their voices built into people's minds. And then we introduce people to Christine, who's our doorway to, you know, this other cast, this wider cast that we've got out there. And, you know, the hope is that when people get to the end of the book, they're going to go and pick up the other books, and it'll be a little bit easier getting into those books because now there's additional characters that they know about.
Right.
And so, yeah, I think that definitely the approach is always different. Depending on what the target audience, what the target purpose, you know, and certainly the length of a book like this, you know, a novella, you know, I tend to not add more characters than I have to have anyway, because otherwise it just gets to be too burdensome on the reader and on me, and it's more names and ranks to get wrong. I think the best thing to do in a really short work is to kind of keep it, you know, laser focused on a small to middling cast, and then with things like, you know, I've got this other, you know, the Star Trek novel for 2015 lined up. You know, that's going to be a much different feeling to that, both in tone and also, you know, we're going to have a much larger cast in that.
Right. Well, and I think one of the neat things that, you know, James did a great novella about Picard and the Nexus. And, you know, I found that reading the novellas are fantastic because you really do get to do smaller character pieces. Mm-hmm. You know, they don't have to be massive universe-altering stories, but they can do a great job of giving you an in-depth look at a character that, you know, like we were talking about, you've seen Riker, and you may have last seen him on screen in Nemesis, and now, you know, when you come after the Fall, he's an admiral. He has a kid, you know, he is married to Troy. They've been married for a while. He was the captain of the Titan. He's not now. I mean, he's got a lot of things going on. And so this story really kind of gave you an opportunity to let him wrestle with all of those issues as a character in a smaller way without feeling like you also have to throw in the entire galaxy's demise as the backdrop to that.
Yeah, you know, I mean, that's
one of the great things.
I think, you know, anyone who reads this, you know, this novella will know that he is now the, you know, he's got this, you know, role as an admiral. But what I don't do is I don't go into why he's the admiral or you know,
right,
everything behind that. I imply that there's a backstory there and people can want to go and, you know, the hope is people will want to go find out more and that they'll get the books. But, you know, it's always a balancing act. You know, just like it's a balancing act, how much stuff do you establish in your own story? And that's one of those places where, having worked in all the various franchises that I've been in, you know, I try really hard not to establish a whole lot of stuff, so that, you know, it confines other writers one day. You know, I might be one of the authors that gets confined by something that I, you know, just do right now as a throwaway line. You know, one of the things, and I actually used this as a line in Kenobi, the Star Wars novel I did last year. You know, the the two words I try to avoid are always and never. Because just as soon as you say, you know, there has never been an Ephrosian who's been the captain of a Constitution class starship, somebody's going to come along and say, well, I wanted to do that. And I was going to set my story in the past, and here, look what you've done to me.
Exactly.
So, you know, put another way, I Randy Stradley, who was the editor of the Star Wars comics at Dark Horse, he always says,
yes,
when you define, you confine. When you go out and add a fact to the universe just for the, just for the point of putting your own imprint on it, and not for a story purpose, there's a good chance that you might be cutting off an avenue that somebody could explore later on. Yeah, there's all sorts of, how many Star Trek and Star Wars and thing, various, franchises, how many books and comic books and things are coming out every year?
It's a
huge number, and it's really important that as many avenues remain open as possible.
For you, too, one of the things that I really noticed about this book, in its levity and its humor, was just the way that you kind of let the characters talk. And I felt like, when we do watch Star Trek, the Next Generation is a little bit more thespian, and sometimes the language can be a little stilted and tight. And in this book, I felt like you were letting the characters breathe a lot and just be able to express the emotions they're having, and everybody feels very, to me, they felt really real. Well, just talk to me a little bit about kind of getting into the characters' heads and writing them.
Well, we have the characters in two different time frames in this story. We have them basically at around the time of season 5. Which is I think that was when this flashback is set of TNG, and then of course we have the bulk of it, which is set much later. The thoughts with my approach to the characters in that earlier time frame, the actors in the TV series, their approaches to the characters, it evolves over the course of the 7 years. And then, of course, into the movies themselves as well. Jonathan Frakes, William Riker, he certainly gets much looser in his delivery as time goes on.
Definitely.
As the series, what is the line on TV Tropes? The series grows the beard.
Exactly.
As we get from that early, if my flashback was set in first season or second season, it wouldn't have been as, the characters probably wouldn't have been as easy and comfortable with each other as they are in that fifth season flashback that we've got, where at that point we actually have seen Picard smile a few times. At that point we have seen these guys confronted with the pack lids and some horrible, just foolish situations that they've had to cope with. And so it actually becomes possible by that point in time that you can have a couple of laughs with these guys. And of course now we get to Riker much later after the end of Nemesis, and Riker in the rest of the book for the most part is just, he's Mr. Cool. He's seen it all. He's dealt with these things before. He lets himself get captured because he knows there's absolutely no way that these characters are going to keep their hands on him. He's able to play for time and do the things that he needs to do. And the fun thing about this is, we're able to have as you mentioned there, there's a scene with him and Deanna, in a situation where they're not sweating this situation at all. They know they've got their way out. We have Ensign Madan, who is in the same jail cell with them. Her reaction is concern. How are we going to get out of this place?
Yes. It's like, I loved that.
It's like,
scene.
No, we got this. Okay, we got this.
Yep.
And meanwhile, of course, we have Tuvok over here, and Tuvok is such a blast because I think between Riker and Tuvok, you've got the best chance for a Kirk Spock dynamic that you're probably gonna
get. Yeah, I
think so too. Because just of their you know the way their personalities are, and you know, I think that you know having him watch these characters, you know, and you know make his sort of wry observations every now and then, you know, I think that added a lot of fun to the project for me, and I think for the readers too. I hope.
Yeah, that was something I kind of wanted to have you talk about a little bit was. You know, after having the big series, the fall, what were you hoping to just kind of talk, to accomplish in that character development of Riker, say, is this is the first book where we're seeing him, you know, out of the fall, he's an admiral and all of that. Where were you kind of hoping to, you know, you don't want to set, you said you don't want to set anything in stone, right. But you know, as a writer, you also want to get to say something about the characters.
Well, you look at, you know, places for story opportunities, and one, you know, real important story opportunity or thing that is out there in all Star Trek, you know, has to do with rank and the responsibilities of rank and the tensions that can be brought on by people, you know, of different ranks in the same situation or, you know, an outside person coming in. You know, back to the original series, I mean, you've got these Federation commissioners that would show up and they would just ruin things.
Yes.
you know, yeah. Mentioning that old West End board game, it was actually written into the rules that if there was a Federation commissioner on the Enterprise, the Klingon player got to decide what the Enterprise did next. Because
that's funny.
Because it would invariably
that's awesome.
It would invariably be the worst possible decision that could be made for the Enterprise. Well, that is something that is actually, you know, I wink at that in the book, and in fact even mentioned, you know, there's, you know,
yep.
And these people that he's had to deal with, and they certainly have had a lot of asinine, you know, admirals that have shown up over the years, or headstrong admirals, or guys that, you know, just came in, took over, tried to do their own things, and so I wanted to throw that in there, and also the fact that this, you know, particular, you know, novella. Yeah, I don't know how much we want to give away about, you know, what episode it's a sequel to and what actually is shown in this story.
We can definitely do spoilers for everyone.
Okay,
so if you haven't read the book, we are going to talk about this point in detail. So you might want to shut off here, but I want to let John Jackson Miller just kind of go with the story now.
Yeah, this story is really a sequel many, many years late to the next phase. And that is, I guess it was a fifth season episode. That's the one everybody remembers where Ro Laren and Geordi LaForge get trapped in, you know, in the phased realm, so
yes,
to speak.
Yeah, yes.
You know, this was our first real, you know, experience with phasing, the notion of being out of step. With reality, you know, they're passing through walls like ghosts and things like that, and it was a fun episode, and one of the reasons that I thought about it with regards to this does relate back to Riker, because phasing was central to the whole Pegasus storyline.
And
that was a case where, you know, Riker's former captain comes back, now an admiral. You know, he was involved with a shady, you know, experiment having to do with phasing technology, you know, which was an offshoot of you know, cloaking technology, which was forbidden by the, you know, by the accords that the Federation had signed. So, you know, it was able to, you know, by having this be a story about phasing, it allowed me to hit Riker with a memory of, you know, a negative incident that really could have wiped out his career.
Yes.
You know, in relation to the story that we've got right now, where he's now an admiral and he's having to make these decisions on his own, and he's saying to himself, "Well, you know, how many situations am I going to be in the future where I'm going to be making decisions that are not necessarily to the best interest of my crew.
Right.
Yeah, and of course, when that happened, you know, when that happened in the Pegasus episode, I mean, it was horrible. There was a mutiny, and a lot of people died. So, yeah, I mean, that was another, I think, fun fact about, you know, where we set the story by putting the story immediately in the days after, or actually in setting the flashback in the days after the next phase. There's even a reference in the next phase, the episode, to we're on our way to Garadius IV. Yes. To negotiate peace. Mm-hmm. You know, it struck me that, you know, by sending it then, that was before Picard found out about the Pegasus incident. That was before.
Right.
That was before any of that happened. And so we have Riker, you know, thinking there in that flashback, you know, oh gosh, you know, phasing. I remember that. So it allows us to take what is the basic plot of the story, which is, you know, has to do with phasing as a possible, you know, weapon, as a possible, as a possible espionage vehicle. And it allows us to tie it back to the subplot that's already going on here of Riker confronting, confronting his new role. And again, the whole idea about, the phasing, certainly there were a lot of questions that original episode, which was a great episode,
yes.
You know, brought up as far as,
the science.
How do these guys? Yeah, science. How do these guys breathe? Why were they not falling through the floors?
Right.
What was the deal with the Romulan who was able to sit on a chair?
Yeah. Right.
You know, a lot of these things. Keith DeCandido had done a review of the episode over on, I guess it was the Tor blog.
Yeah.
You know, there was this big long thread of conversations, including. I think Christopher Bennett had his own theory about how phasing worked, and I said that sounds like it could work. But then as I was writing my own story about it, I realized, well, I'm going to have to put my own tweaks on that as well, because I think Christopher had come up with an idea that, well, the reason they don't fall through the floor is because of the anti-gravity in the decking plates.
Oh, perfect. I thought it was just that. Phasing only worked horizontally, so vertically you're safe.
Well, it's the,
horizontally.
This is the thing. It has to work both ways, because they did pass their hands through through physical barriers.
Yep.
Geordi would stick his hand into the monitors.
Right.
I honestly, it's scary to say this, but I watched that episode four times while I was writing this book, because I wanted to make sure that I was reflecting everything that could have been done then, and I was trying to come up with a technobabble explanation for why it worked the way that it did. And since I was putting my adventure on a planet, I couldn't get away with the deck plating thing. So yeah, I did have to come up with an explanation that. You know, it's in the novella, I think, and I didn't say that this is how all phasing works everywhere. It's just this particular kind of phasing, because once again, I'm trying not to establish anything too much. There is that line in there that somebody says, "Well, it might not always work like this. This is just how it works here and now." But you know, that was, and of course the larger thing about the whole phasing thing is it allowed me to tell a story that I think had a Star Trek feel to it, with regard to, the issue of war and peace.
Definitely.
The idea for this thing that I had in the story, it was actually in a pitch I wrote for an X-Men comic book like 11 years ago. Or actually,
oh, wow.
It wasn't X-Men. It was Starjammers. I don't know if you know what Starjammers.
Starjammers.
It was a story where and of course I have.
Wasn't Starjammers that movie with Michael Jordan where he was a space basketball player?
Wrong one. No, that was
and Bugs Bunny was with him.
That's Space Jam. Yeah,
that's the Space Jam, man. Yes. Yeah, no, that's I don't know. You know, before all this publishing stuff, yeah, I've got a degree in international relations. That's what my master's was in. So I was interested in telling stories about war and peace and conflict. And this original, pitch that I came up with just a long time ago, I guess it's 12 years ago now, visualized the notion of what if there were two groups of warring peoples that claim the same place as their holy land or whatever it was. What if you could use technology, sort of with the whole Schrodinger's cat thing, to allow them to be in the same place at the same time, quantum mechanics or whatever it was going to mm-hmm. be. What if they actually were sharing the same physical space, just out of step with each other by, a half a millisecond? Would that be possible? And what would the ramifications of that be? Well, that was just a story pitch that I had a long time ago. It didn't go anywhere. But as I was thinking about Star Trek and phasing, I realized, well, that's exactly what I'm describing here. This is a way to be in the same place at the same time with somebody else. It's just there are a number of problems with it. One of them is nothing is physically real in the phased world. So if you're gonna try to be in the same place with another group, you better pack a lunch.
Right.
And so I began thinking through what would the logistics be of sharing the same place. And then of course I won't give everything away, but there are some downsides to the whole situation as well. But it just struck me that it would work out as something that would be a fun Star Trek story. It would have the feeling of Star Trek, and that's what's important. By having sort of this Star Trek science bent to it, it's the kind of story that I couldn't tell in another tie-in universe.
Right, exactly.
People always ask, what's the difference between writing Star Wars and Star Trek?
Yeah, you that was actually one of my questions.
Yeah, you can just feel it. You can say to yourself when you're writing a plot development for either series, okay, this feels a little bit too Star Trek, or this feels a little bit too Star Wars. This is not in keeping with the whole feel of the series. And in fact, that's as we said earlier, that's how everybody judges these things anyway. Does this feel too much like a something that belongs in another milieu? I to sort of paraphrase the old Supreme Court justice, how do I know when something is Star Trek? I know it when I see it.
Right.
I know it. I can sort of take an idea and put it into the context of all the other Trek things that I've seen and read and gamed over the years, and we all do this. Say, okay, this feels like it belongs.
Yeah, definitely. For you, getting into Star Trek as a kid, did you end up, after all the series that have happened, did you end up having, you said Riker was your favorite character, did you end up having a favorite crew or one of the shows just for you is always going to be your favorite?
Well, Riker is my favorite character out of Next Gen. Out of the original series, McCoy, way McCoy.
I'm with you there. He's my favorite too.
I've got Doctor's Orders is one of the old books from the original batch of novels that I've got around here. It's interesting one of the guys that I edited at Comics Buyer's Guide is a name very familiar to the Star Trek audience, Peter David.
Yes.
Peter was our columnist. He was our back page columnist for 20 years, just about. And he wrote about Trek, you know, and the differences between the shows and the different feelings between the shows, you know, for many years. And I remember I was in grad school, not working, you know, at the magazine at all. You know, when he first wrote, I think this is like 2 years into Next Gen, that, you know, original series is about the characters. Next Gen is about the Federation. It's about the universe. It's about, it's about everything else. And this was before Next Gen, as we were saying earlier, started to focus a lot more on the characters and the relationships. The relationships hadn't really formed yet in the very early days. And so, you know, you get to episodes in the later series, and certainly with a movie like Insurrection, that, you know, has that more comfortable feel between the characters, and it feels like it's more about the characters. You know, what I may be the only guy in the world. My favorite of the original cast Star Trek movies, I like Wrath of Khan like everybody else. I will watch Episode 3, or rather Star Trek 3, anytime it's on.
Yeah.
Yeah, I love 3 too.
Because it what does it do that you know, I've been talking about? It boils it down to just the core cast. It's you know, six guys in a starship, leaving poor Uhura behind. It's five until we get Spock back. But anyway, it absolutely, you know, there's that feeling of you know, freedom right when they take off from the starbase. That you look at that and you feel that and you say, wow, this could just go anywhere.
Oh, definitely.
This could go anywhere, and you know, it really in that film, I think, you know, crystallized you know, the camaraderie, which I think was the strength of the original series. And I think that's what you want to look for. What is the central, you know, fun thing about each series, and what's the thing that you like to see? You know, I certainly like the camaraderie of the first series. I like the camaraderie of the second series once it all gels and develops. I like, you know, the fun political stories that they did. You know, the whole, you know, the whole Worf arc that starts, you know, with the, you know, the discommodation thing and just goes on forward through the, you know, the Klingon Civil War.
Yes.
I was so into that. Again, you know, when that was going on, when the Klingon Civil War was cooking, I was in a Soviet studies graduate program.
Oh, nice.
I was actually in a Russian immersion.
I was too.
Well, were you?
Yeah, I have a degree in Russian, actually. And yeah, exactly the same stuff at the same time, too, probably.
Like around 1990,
91, 92. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, that's cool. Where did you go? What college?
I got my degree from the University of Alabama, but I also went to Indiana University for Russian courses as well.
I was at the Indiana University's Russian Language Institute in the summer of 1991.
Oh, okay. We were there in 94, so 3 years later.
Okay. Yeah. Okay, yeah. That was where I saw
That's
killer.
Awesome.
That is the Letny Institut Ruski Yazyk, or whatever it was.
My wife and I both were there in 94, in the same immersion program, yeah.
Okay, yeah, Eigenman Hall. They stuck us all.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, I ended up having to sneak away to Steak and Shake to eat every night.
That's awesome. Yeah.
Because I couldn't speak Russian well enough to ask for anything.
cool.
Well, that is cool. Yeah, but you know, that there was always that very, you know Russian, you know, feeling of and that goes all the way back to the 60s. You know, that Cold War feeling of the Federation, the Klingons, and you know, certainly we, you know, at that time, you know, I just really dug those episodes, and you know, the Klingon Civil War was reflective of what was happening, you know, with the Soviet Union at the time, not a civil war, but I mean, certainly that, you know, they were dealing with the breakup of the country, and so, yeah, I mean, I think that really sort of tripped the, you know, triggers that I had, things that I was interested in. Deep Space Nine, the later series, I, you know, really enjoy, you know, the deep political story that you've got there.
Yes, there's, definitely.
This is a lot closer to, I think what I was trying to do in Knights of the Old Republic, a big sprawling story.
I can see that.
That takes in a lot of things at once, and then it all comes to a head in that final episode where everything is, all hell is breaking loose
right.
at once. I really dug that. Voyager, I enjoyed some of the, stories there, some of the characters, there as well. So, and of course, obviously I've got Tuvok in the book here. Yep. It's really hard for me to play favorites. A little of everything. I'm really appreciative of having gotten the opportunity. It turns out it was a second chance, to come
right.
and do something for the Star Trek universe.
Well, I think it's so cool that you did get the opportunity. One, I really enjoyed, the work that you did in Star Wars. I read, all the Knights of the Old Republic, all the Knight Errant. I read Kenobi, and which for me, I've been waiting for that kind of book with Obi-Wan for a long time, just where it was focused on his character, because I think there's so much more to that character than we ever really even get to see on screen. They got to explore a lot of it in the Clone Wars, but there's so much more there that can be done. And so I was really excited that happened. And I'm glad that you're getting now to play in the Star Trek sandbox, because I enjoyed very much the characterization you had, the little bit more of the laid back feel, that kind of insurrection feel that I think we need every once in a while in Star Trek. It's important to get that. And, it was a lot of fun. So for you, John, what's coming up next for you? Like, what do the listeners need to be looking for from you? And then two, where can they follow you for the latest news online?
Okay. Well, I'm working on a number of projects at the same time here, and not all of them have been announced. One that has been announced, and of course this, mentioned probably on this podcast before, I have a Star Trek full-length novel that is slated for 2015, presuming I can actually get the thing finished. as Margaret said in a previous interview, it's an Aventine novel, or Aventine.
Aventine.
Is there an audiobook? Yeah, yeah, Aventine. That's
I
good.
Think it's the Aventine. Yeah,
Aventine. Yes. It involves that cast. But it also involves the Enterprise cast as well.
Oh, okay.
And I can't get into any more specifics, even the name, right now. Oh. Just
okay. I was going to ask you if you've had any thoughts about the name, but
I've got the name already. It is one of those things where I just came up with a story that I had always wanted to see.
Oh, excellent.
It's a much, more of a sprawling adventure story. It is, whereas the novella has the feel of a single episode, you want the novel to feel like a feature film. And so that's really what I've got here. And, I'm looking forward to, getting, more hip deep into it. As I said, I've got some other projects coming out beforehand. Also announced. I have a short story that's in a anthology called Apollo's Daughters. There was a Kickstarter earlier this year.
Oh yeah, I saw that. Yeah.
Yeah. There was a Kickstarter earlier this year called Athena's Daughters, which was female science fiction authors writing female lead characters, and the Kickstarter did so well that they went out and they got Mike Stackpole and several other authors, including myself, to provide short stories with female lead characters. And excellent. In my case, I'm doing a short story that draws upon the Overdraft universe. Overdraft is a science fiction series of my own. That I started actually a couple of years ago in a short story in in the Armored anthology that Bane Books put out. And then I followed it up last year with a serial that we did through 47 North, and it has now been collected into a full-length novel, Overdraft, the Orion Offensive. This is set in my own science fiction universe where... Okay. I guess if you wanted to say you wanted to split the difference between Star Trek and Star Wars, it's here.
Okay.
It's got elements of both, and so I think fans of Trek would be interested in it. It is set in the 22nd century future of Earth after we have discovered other civilizations and we have joined sort of the intergalactic trading system.
Nice.
And the story is about a high risk stock trader who bankrupts his expedition from his desktop. And the space marines with the expedition don't want to go into unemployment. And so they come back to Earth and they grab him and they say, you're going to come back with us to all the most dangerous planets with all the most dangerous species that nobody will trade with. And you're going to get all of our money back. That is Overdraft. And it is a fun, since we did it as a serial, it's got that planet of the month or planet of the week kind of a feeling to it.
Oh, great.
Going from one disaster to another, it has sort of that lighter feeling that you saw in this Star Trek book, and also in my Knights of the Old Republic series. But there are also some deep thought in there about how civilization is and how my particular science fiction universe works. Probably the best thing that you get when you get to do your own universe is You get to decide the rules. You get to decide the physics. You get to say, okay, I like the limitation that having no instantaneous communication between stars introduces. It makes interstellar trade feel like the age of sailing ships. when you didn't know where something arrived or not. I like the fact that in my universe, nothing. Can go between stars any larger than a railroad car, which means that if you're going to build a big spaceship, you have to break the thing down and then put it back together Lego style on the other side.
Nice. That's fun.
And it means you have a different feeling, so that everything is not all hyperspace warp.
Right.
All of that. It's not all, subspace communications. It's, there's a different thing. There's a different feeling to it. And I think that's really what, as a writer, you want you want to write in some different universes so that you can get to play with some different devices, some different story devices.
Exactly.
I have to say the best feeling that I had writing the Star Trek novella here was I had the characters in a jam and I said to myself, oh, wait, they've got a transporter.
Yep.
Because I had spent so many stories in Star Wars and in Mass Effect,
yep.
Figuring out, okay, how are we going to get the shuttle to these guys?
Yep.
Because we don't have any other way to get the people off the planet.
But of course, if you write enough Star Trek, you have to figure out, how am I going to break the transporter so I then have to get the shuttle to these guys?
That's exactly it. I haven't had to break the transporter yet. That's the limitation there. You've absolutely put your finger on it. You have to think in a completely different way.
Yeah.
Why don't they just transport them out? Every milieu you're in, you have that different set of rules to work with. And that's why it's fun to work with some different ones. As I said, Overdraft, folks can find that on Amazon. Folks can find out about all my books on farawaypress.com. I have a behind-the-scenes page with trivia for every comic book, every game, every novel I've ever done. The Star Trek page is already set up for Absent Enemies, but I will be getting the trivia and the notes up for that. It's sort of like a DVD extra. It's like my commentary of the book without actually following along with the book. It's my notes on it. So people can find that at farawaypress.com. They can find me on Twitter at JJMFaraway. And then they can find me on Facebook at John Jackson Miller.
Awesome.
Also, John, we should point out, because we mentioned in the news segment that Kenobi is on Audible, your Overdraft the Orion Offensive is also available as an audiobook, unabridged audiobook on Audible. So yes. You can grab that there too.
Yeah, it is fun. I got my first two audiobooks in the same year, and you know, I have been listening to that you know, in with my kids in the car, and they absolutely will not let me listen to anything else.
Oh, really?
So it's good. It's a good thing that I enjoy the story. But
there you go.
Actually, that I do have a couple of other releases right there. That reminds me sometime this summer we're going to be getting the paperback edition of Star Wars Kenobi.
Okay. Yep. I saw that.
And at the end of April, we'll be getting the third and final Star Wars Knights of the Old Republic omnibus.
Oh,
and
yes. Yep.
That completes the entire 56 issue series. That is the end of my Star Wars work at Dark Horse, because that license has moved. That is not the end of, you know, my work for Dark Horse. I just did a Conan story,
which was a real
change of pace. It was it was in the Robert E. Howard Savage Sword issue that came out.
Okay.
And so there's that. And as I say, there's that Apollo's Daughters thing. I should mention Apollo's Daughters also has a cover by Joe Caroni. Joe has done many covers for the Star Trek comics at IDW,
and
Joe was the artist on my first comic series.
Oh, wow.
That was Crimson Dynamo. So, which again is the whole Russian thing. That was, as we mentioned before, I got a Soviet studies degree. The Soviet Union collapsed on my dissertation. Yeah. and all I got out of it was a plot for a comic book.
Well, John, I thought the Crimson Dynamo, I thought that was your comic series about the Alabama football team.
Oh, no. I neglected to mention that, yes, I was at Indiana for the language program. Uh-huh. As an undergraduate, I graduated from the University of Tennessee, and as a grad student, and I was a graduate student at LSU. So,
and Matthew is a Texas A&M guy, so we've got like all SEC sports ball going.
Oh, here. Good grief! Yeah, well, yeah. See, I live in Wisconsin. You know what they do in Wisconsin? They go curling. Well, we got the Packers, and that's enough up here. But but yes, I certainly am longing for the weather of the South after having been up here for 20 years. Yeah.
Well, John, thank you so much for joining us. I loved the book, and I'm looking forward to very much the Aventine novel. I think you're going to write a great Dax, and I'm excited to hear that the Enterprise is going to be involved somehow. So we'll wait for that, and we'll be really excited. I can't wait to have you back to talk about that as well. But I really appreciate so much your time and coming on the show with us.
And I appreciate you having me. I got to say the welcome that I've gotten from the Trek community has just been really great, and I definitely appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks so much, John. Well, Matthew, that was so much fun talking to John Jackson Miller. Great to hear about the background. I didn't know that he actually had written Star Trek before writing Star Wars, so that was great to find out. And to find out that we both went to the same program at the same university was also quite a surprise.
Yeah, I mean, it is so crazy that, you know, the world feels so big sometimes, and then sometimes it just feels so small. And so it was great to have him on. I loved getting to talk to him. You can tell that he's excited to be writing in the Star Trek universe, and I'm really glad that he's going to get to continue to do that. So I definitely wish him all the best and more books to come. And so great way to start with Titan novella, and look forward to his Aventine novel for sure.
Yeah, it's too bad we couldn't fish that title for the Aventine novel out of it.
Yeah, I think I think it was there. I think he almost said a few things that he didn't want to. So, good for him. I don't want him to get in trouble and then not be able to come back.
That's right. All right. So yeah, it was great talking today, but it's not the only thing we've been talking about here on the network. So here are some other things you may have missed elsewhere on Trek FM.
Previously on Trek.fm, Standard Orbit.
Marathons for new viewers.
If someone were to say to my 13-year-old self, here is every single episode of Star Trek ever made, I just don't know what I would do. I honestly think I probably wouldn't appreciate the shows as much as I do because they'd be so disposable.
Earl Grey.
Death Bowl and Hollow Pursuits.
Did he override anything or did he actually just walk right in?
No, he just hit the button.
He just went boopity boop boop.
The Ready Room.
The Apple with Mark Cushman.
But he's standing outside this building talking to Val. And there was this one point in the script where the writer wrote, Val reacts to what Kirk said. And Bob Justin in his memo said, I'm sitting here trying to imagine how a building is going to react to what our Captain Kirk says.
The Orb.
Runabouts.
It definitely feels more like the Old West. Mm-hmm. You know, and you're basically in a covered wagon instead of like a train.
But so. A covered wagon that can go warp 5.
To the journey!
Q on Voyager.
You know, you got the chocolates and the roses and, you know, the
I'm
puppies.
I'm not talking about
like
the puppy.
Yes. Someone had to do it.
I'm not talking about the puppy.
Warp 5.
Malcolm Reed.
It almost feels like the writers thought it was fun to just keep throwing facts in and dialogue about him. You know, usually in the show Bible, you want to see people do things, and they just say, oh, we'll have this person say this. We'll have a whole episode about how he loves pineapple, but he's allergic to it.
Commentary, Trek Stars.
Robert Hewitt Wolf Recap.
So it was like Three Amigos or Galaxy Quest, but with Anne Rice?
I think it might have been. I could be wrong about that. I don't know.
That sounds, you know, equally amazing and horrible.
Melodic Treks.
Dick Fontaine and DS9's Jazz.
In 1983... Darren was offered the role of Jim Corrigan on ABC series TJ Hooker. The part of Hooker, as many of you will know, was played by none other than William Shatner or Captain James Tiberius Kirk.
Literary Treks.
The Insolence of Office.
But Starfleet's a military organization, and when you sign up for Starfleet, you're joining that group, and I think that you give up some of your rights in that situation.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So check out all of these shows and get your daily Trek Talk fix. We have new Trek Talk for you every day of the week, and some days we even have two shows for you, and you'll find them in a wide variety of places, including on iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn, Windows Phone, Xbox, and Zune, or you can stream or download from the website. So grab some shows and find out what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe. Matthew, we'd also like to remind everyone to drop by and give us a rating in iTunes if you have a chance, and a review. We keep an eye on that store. We love to hear your thoughts on the show, and that's a great way to help other listeners or other fans of Star Trek literature find the show in iTunes when they are searching, because it's not really that easy to find the few shows that are around about the literary universe. So if you have a moment, please drop by and do that. And then if you want to send us other feedback about the show, you can go to trek.fm/contact. There's a form there. Choose to send to a show and choose Literary Treks. That will come to both Matthew and me by email. You can also send us voicemail through the website, or you can go to trek.fm/forums to talk to us and other listeners about the show, about Star Trek books and comics, or anything you want to talk about Star Trek right there on the website. Again, that's trek.fm/forums. In social media, you'll find us on Facebook at facebook.com/trekfm, and you'll find us on Twitter under username trekfm, where we're always tweeting away about Star Trek. Now, Matthew, when you're not learning how to throw chairs against the wall like Riker does in this book, where can people find you?
Well, Chris, you can find me on Twitter at MattRushing02. And then, of course, we do a show about Deep Space Nine called The Orb, so you can find me there. And then I also have my own personal blog at 42lifeinbetween.wordpress.com. So you can find me there for all sorts of my writings that I do on lots of different subjects. And so now, Chris, when you're not phasing in and out of our space-time continuum in different ways, where can we find you?
Well, you never know, because I could be right there next to you right now. Just phased out of dimension just a little
bit. Scared the crap out of me. Chris, don't do that.
You never know where you'll find me.
Which I have to mention, Chris, I meant to ask John about this, but there is the funniest phrase ever, crud bunnies, in the book. Yeah. So, holy crud bunnies, Chris. No more scaring me like that.
Holy crud bunnies. Oh, wow. No, you can find me on Twitter. My username is C. Brian Jones. That's the letter C and Brian with a Y. You can find me pretty much everywhere in social media under that same username, as well as on my personal website at cbrianjones.com. And besides doing The Orb with Matthew, you can find me every week on The Ready Room with hosts from all around the network and other special guests as we talk about Star Trek news and all five live-action Star Trek series. You can also find me on Warp 5, where we talk exclusively about Enterprise. And I have my own interview show as well called Matter Stream. So check all those out if you're interested. Before we let you go, we'd also like to remind you about our sponsor for today's show, Audible.com, the best source for audiobooks online. As we mentioned, they have over 150,000 titles available, but as we also mentioned, they have both Kenobi and Overdraft, The Orion Offensive by John Jackson Miller, which John talked about a good bit there in the interview today. And you can get either one of those absolutely free as a Trek FM listener. Just go to audibletrial.com/trekfm and sign up for a trial. Choose one of those books or anything you want, and if after the trial period you decide not to stick with Audible, there's nothing to lose because you get to keep those audiobooks. So go sign up today, find out what's going on there in John Jackson Miller's books, and we really thank Audible for helping us keep the show coming to you. Again, that's over at audibletrial.com/trekfm. Another way you can help us keep the show coming to you is to make a donation to the network. If you go to trek.fm/donate, you'll find different levels of contributions to choose from, as well as alien badges and art prints as a thank you. And those are original illustrations by Tobu Ushi, who does most of the artwork that you see on our website. And your support helps us pay for the cost of production, hosting, and bandwidth that's needed to bring Literary Treks and all of our shows to you every week. So we really thank you for helping us keep the network going. Again, check that out at trek.fm/donate.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, and until next time, live long and read on.
What do you call that, light reading?
To each his own, number one.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, and we'll see you next time. Oh, gosh.
As we gaze into the book.
Into the book.